Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 173, and we're in modern day Mpumalanga and Limpopo. We heard last how Hendrik Potgieter's voortrekkers had camped at a new town they named Urgstad in 1845 after leaving the area around Potchefstroom. Potgieter wanted to move further away from the British, and he sought a new port to replace Durban, which had been annexed by the English. The area around Urgstad had one major drawback, apart from the fact it was already populated by the Bapedi. The lowlands were rife with malaria. Within a few weeks of arriving, it was the rainy season after all of 1845, men, women and children began dying like flies, according to the reports. The trekkers realized they had to move once more, so families packed up their wagons and trekked to higher ground 50 kilometers south. They named the new town Leidenbach and established a new republic named after the town. The Boers were gathered now across the Vaal, deep into the low veld, spreading out across southern Africa. They had congregated around towns like Windbach, Potchefstroom, Urgstad, Leidenbach. Local African chieftains had to decide how they were going to face this new arrival. Was it a threat or an opportunity? Later, it would obviously become clear that the Boers' arrival was a threat, but this wasn't the case at first, in spite of modern assumptions. They were the new power brokers, thinly spread, a minority on the ground, and the Bapedi chief Sekwati, for example, quickly came to the conclusion that the trekkers were an opportunity rather than a threat. His history needs a little explanation. When Mzilikazi fled from northern Zululand, he had attacked other groups, including the Bapedi, who lived along the Olifants River. They were forced to flee, and for the next few years, the oral history speaks of how they wandered around the Soutpansberg and the Blauberg, raiding small kraals, capturing women and children. Then Sekwati returned across the Olifants River and re-established his control of that part of the country, although not without meeting other resistance. The tribal stronghold was established at Piring, north of Urgstad. However, attacks by the AmaZulu continued, as well as by the Amswazi. Sekwati was well-versed in defensive tactics against these sort of enemies, withdrawing into the mountains and never meeting the AmaZulu or the AmaSwazi in pitched open battles. Although he had repulsed the AmaZulu and avoided the AmaSwazi, Sekwati realized that both groups were the biggest threat to Bapedi security, and he began paying a protection fee in cattle and sometimes women on an annual basis to the Swazi royal house. However, according to the Bapedi, this didn't make them vassals of the Swazi king. It was merely judicious. So when Hendrik Potgieter and his trekkers rolled onto the landscape, a meeting was arranged between the Boer leader and the Bapedi chief. On the 5th of July, 1845, a Friedenstraktat was signed, a treaty which granted the Boers the land east of the Steelpoort River. As I pointed out last episode, many of the Boers who had trekked with Potgieter took exception to this treaty. They said he was acting dictatorially and wanted more of a say in how these treaties were being signed. When these Boers approached Sekwati separately, he rejected the idea of being given the land east of the Steelpoort instead, the Bapedi chief pointing out that he had already granted that territory to Potgieter. King Mswati of the Swazis, who lived southeast of this region, was aware of what was going on. The Boers understood that he also laid claim to the Steelpoort and had been fighting constantly with Sekwati about who had the right to this region. Mswati met with this group of dissatisfied Boers and told them that the Bapedi were his subjects. He defeated them. To this day, these claims and counterclaims have not been fully resolved, so it's with caution that I continue with this tale. Mswati duly gave away Bapedi land to the Boers, and as a deal sweetener, offered to drive the Bapedi away, which would leave the land ready for exploitation. The Boers under Potgieter and the second group, who regarded themselves as independent of Potgieter's actions, continued to settle on Bapedi land, and friction developed. The Bapedi took a liking to the Boer cattle, and raids escalated quickly into full-blown attacks between the two groups on the veld. Sekwati had heard about the Boers and Mswati's recent talks, so naturally he was suspicious of their motives. The Bapedi king encouraged the raiding of Boer cattle, so by 1846, bad faith seemed to imbue all negotiations. Then an incident occurred that escalated matters. According to the Bapedi annals, the Boers complained that in joint Boer-Bapedi hunting parties, The Bapedi had taken more than their allotted share of the game that had been shot. The Boer annals report something more violent. That was the Bapedi raid on a Boer lager at Straatpoort, just south of modern-day Polokwane. The trekkers were particularly angry because the Bapedi raided the lager apparently on a day that most of the men were away hunting with a section of other Bapedi, leaving the women alone. It was the women who fought off the attackers. There are poignant stories told by trekkers who survived, explaining how the women were knocked flat on their backs every time they fired these huge, heavy muskets, leaving them bruised and battered, but unbowed. Eventually, the trekker women managed to drive off the Bapedi warriors, but Hendrik Potgieter realized that his flimsy land deal with Sequati had collapsed. Now he raised a commando 150 strong, more than 100 warriors from nearby Baralong chief Matlabe joined the Boers. A third group of mixed-race family members of Koenraad the Base and a Durs Base threw in their lot with Potgieter too, at least 30 men. If you've listened to this entire series, you'll remember Koenraad the Base, the maverick Dutch giant, a fantastic figure in our amazing story. De Base fled his family farm in the Lang Kloof after a dispute with family members. In 1813, after many scrapes and adventures, the large De Base family moved to the area north of the Gariep River, and by 1818 was on the move towards the Limpopo River. He died in 1820, but he left the vast clan of mixed-race De Base family members, whose descendants still live around Soutpansberg in the northern Limpopo province. And here, back in 1847, with 30 members of his extended clan, the De Base men fighting alongside their brethren, the Boers, against the Bapedi. Sequati was duly defeated and had to flee his home once more. First it was the Amandebele, now it was the Boers attacking him. Potgieter's men took over 8,000 head of cattle and 6,000 goats from Sequati, dividing the spoils amongst the trekkers, the Baralong, and the De Boses. The reason why all of this matters is, of course, land. Who owned the land around Urichstad? Did Sequati actually give it away, or was it lent? The treaty signed in 1845 has subsequently disappeared, so we don't even have that piece of parchment to use historically. The hunter, raider, trader aspect of Potgieter's style of rule has also muddied the logical waters. And just adding a little complexity, there was an influx of voortrekkers from Natal around now who decided to leave the territory because the British had taken control of Durban and the surrounding areas. The Urichstad and Leidenberg Volksraads and other Boers decided that things could not continue with Sequati. Despite his defeat, he continued to be less than forthcoming about how he regarded the trekker position on his land. So Potgieter's nemesis, as historian Philip Bonner puts it, was the Volksraad-Swazi Agreement signed in July 1846. These things are fascinating because they involve intrigue and myth-making. First, the intrigue. Potgieter had kept a crucial bit of information away from the Volksraad regarding Swazi claims to a vast tract of land between the Crocodile and Olifants rivers. After their experience with Sequati and the confusion, the Volksraad bypassed Potgieter to sign this agreement when they found out he'd hid this bit of information about the ownership of this vast tract of land. There's more intrigue. The trekkers had no idea about who really owned that bit of land. They naturally assumed that Mswati was the overlord, considering his people's military social structure, similar to the AmaZulu, who by now they knew well. Mswati, according to oral tradition, sent word to the Volksraad that he was indeed the owner of the land between the Crocodile and Olifants rivers, and he was willing to sell this to the trekkers for 110 head of cattle. This bit of info reached the Boers at the same time as word reached Mswati that his elder brother Malambule had contacted Zulu King Impande, asking for help to oust the Swazi regent. Well, intrigue upon intrigue. Impande, all the way in the south, caught up his army and prepared them for a new assault on the Mswazi. Meanwhile, Malambule moved his great place south, ready to receive the AmaZulu warriors, whom he hoped would help him seize power. So let's step back a little and have a look. It's now considered as fact that Mswati I had approached the Volksraad, knowing that their archenemy, the AmaZulu, were about to pitch up. These Boers could be useful in his coming war against his brother. He also knew that Impande was soft-soaping the British, the very same people the Boers hated. The agreement between the Boers and King Mswati came not a moment too soon, because Mswati's forces clashed with Malambule's warriors at a place called Mahamba a few weeks later. Mahamba is northeast of Port Pietersburg, just across the modern-day border between South Africa and Eswatini. Malambule wasn't done. He headed back to his great place at La Vumisa, to the southeast. That's a town that straddles the border with South Africa, just north of the modern Bongolapur Dam. 6 weeks later, Malambule received word that Mpande's troops were on the move, so he mobilized once more, moving off parallel to the Bongola River towards the mission station run by James Allison. Mswati had also mobilized his warriors, and the two sides converged near the mission station where they fought a pitched battle that went very badly for Malambule. His defeated warriors fled south across the Pongola into the territory of Nyamanja, Magonodo, and Mhlangampisi, all allies of Mpande. The AmaZulu king was now provided with his long-awaited excuse to invade Mswati's land directly and possibly annex parts of the southern reaches. It was in February 1846 that Mpande had sent a message to the British officer in charge in Natal asking for permission to extract reparations from the Swazi. Mpande was in his own internal dispute with a chief named Mawa, who lived south of the Tugela, and the Zulu king said he would drop all claims to Mawa's cattle if Lieutenant Governor West gave the green light for a full invasion of Swaziland. We know that Malambule was aware of Mpande's predicament, so creating a bit of chaos inside Mswati's kingdom made political sense. Mpande also knew that his erstwhile ally Malambule would retreat towards the headwaters of the Pongola River. Mswati would probably follow, and this would provide the AmaZulu king with the opportunity to attack the Swazis on open ground. The area at the headwaters was also contested ground, another reason why Mpande's plan was extremely well thought out. This first civilian lieutenant governor of Natal, Martin West, was living in Durban, and his notes from this period make for interesting reading. In August the previous year, West had reported that Mpande had sent a messenger explaining how Mswati had invaded his territory, and in suitable political speak, the AmaZulu king judged it prudent to be prepared for any emergency. Just out of interest, Durban's old West Street and the suburb of Westville are named after Martin West, and so was Westville Boys High School. Mpande watched proceedings extremely closely. It may have been September 1846, but news still travelled very fast indeed. So when Malambule fled to the headwaters of the Pongola, chased by Mswati, Mpande set his army in motion. It should also be mentioned that Mswati had hired 4 Boer mercenaries who helped swing the tide of battle with their muskets. But Mswati was being drawn inexorably into a trap, following up on Malambule being drawn further south into the contested area, just as Mpande had planned. This got worse when the Swazi warriors flattened the kraals of Magonondo and Mhlangampisi, the Zulu king's allies. Mpande now had more diplomatic ammunition and rattled off a new message to the British Lieutenant Governor West, warning it was time to repel an invasion of his land. Not only would they defend the land, but Mpande said his warriors would follow the Swazi as far as they needed to go to recover cattle. The Lieutenant Governor could do very little faced with the facts, and agreed that the AmaZulu king had no choice but to defend his land. Mpande, unlike Dingane, could play a very nuanced geopolitical game. He had a gifted understanding for the infinities of diplomacy. He was a canny operator, far smarter than he's been given credit. He outwitted the British Lieutenant Governor, who was completely at a loss. This manoeuvring had taken months of planning, and here was the AmaZulu king running his own northern border in the manner he saw fit. The only problem with this chess match is that it wasn't a simple matter of black versus white, because lurking within the land were the voortrekkers, and Mswati was going to use them as his ace up his sleeve. In these wild days of the African frontier, enemies and allies switched sides constantly, and so it was rather ironic that Mswati sought refuge with the Boers, when within a few years he would regard them as his most dangerous opponent. And the feeling by then was mutual too. But let's go back to the invasion tale. By 1847, the American missionary Aldwin Grout, after whom Groutville north of Durban is named, reported that Mpande had instructed Putini and Mhlangampisi to cut poles to assist in the making of villages in the north of Zululand. Grouts said that Mpande had told chiefs of his intention to, as the AmaZulu say, plough in Swaziland that year. That meant to invade and set up his own chieftainships. There were signs of an impending invasion, with Mpande's armies already massing on the southern bank of the Pongola, and in early 1847, Mpande went ahead with his full frontal invasion of Swazi territory. Mpande's armies swept through the country all the way to the Crocodile River, heading northwest. Most of the Swazis they were chasing took refuge with the Boers, and a stalemate set in. On the one hand, the Zulu could not subdue the Swazi because they took refuge in caves or with their Urgstad-Ledenburgpoort neighbours, and on the other hand, the Swazi were not in a position to expel the AmaZulu invaders. This was a messy moment, because in the midst of all this fighting and positioning, Hendrik Potgieter, in an unbelievably unilateral moment, made an effort to align with the AmaZulu king Mpande, contradicting the Volksraad's own stance of supporting the AmaSwazi. Crazy, isn't it, this political stuff? To put it another way, the Volksraad and the supporters of Potgieter were on the verge of hostilities against each other over who to support, the AmaSwazi or the AmaZulu. Eventually, the AmaZulu raiding parties withdrew in July 1847 when the Volksraad and Potgieter patched things up and decided to put pressure on Mpande to leave Urgstad. What is quite important to note here is that historically the role that the black chiefs played in the Boer-Internecine quarrels, which were quietly suppressed through the decades, and by the time of apartheid, the history books failed to mention any of this inter-Boer shenanigan at all. Most reports about what Potgieter did north and west of Urgstad and how he negotiated with the Bapedi and other local people disappeared. However, we do have quite a bit about what was going on between the Boers and the AmaSwazi. The Volksraad's agreement with the King of Swati was a bone of contention because Potgieter had not negotiated this treaty himself. He had been sidelined. So it was vitally important for him as an autocrat to sign something that was newer with his name on it. Then he could claim political relevancy. By the end of 1847 and starting in 1848, Potgieter began a propaganda war against this treaty, casting doubt on its authenticity. A really interesting transcript of an interview between Mswati's older brother, Somtuba, and the Volksraad in July 1848 reveals that the Raad members believed Potgieter was fiddling around with the treaty, tampering with it, in the official record phraseology. Somtuba, meanwhile, had also been up to his own form of skullduggery, trying to usurp his brother Mswati's rule. The landscape in the region lends itself to mystery in many ways because Urgstad and Ledenburg are nestled in the foothills of the top end of the Drakensberg Mountains, close to the Bladder River Canyon, God's Window. There are canyons and cliffs and ravines, dark, dank, thickly wooded, fast-flowing rivers where the mists rise, and the place is full of caves, large caves, many with signs of ancient human habitation, and the Bapedi retreated deep into these when attacked by the AmaSwazi. They used the hollow stalactites striking them to set up a noise as a kind of warning system. These caves are particularly ancient, chiselled by weathering in Precambrian dolomite rock, which was first laid down around 3.8 billion years ago, when Africa was still part of Gondwana, and this cave system is considered one of the oldest in the world. Later, as the Bapedi were forced from the area, knowledge about the caves went with them, until a farmer rediscovered the entrances only in 1923. But we're back in 1848, and there's news of a new trek. Potgieter, the old man of the veld, had had enough of the Volksraad friction. He was still searching for his nirvana, and in the middle of that year, he decided to up and off northwards. The Boers were conflicted about what to do. Most of the voortrekkers north of the Vaal River supported Potgieter, believing he was the father of the great trek and that he could do no wrong. He was ordained by God, they said. Like more contemporary political leaders who believe they're ordained by God. And his supporters were fanatics. And as we all know, once a political leader is supposedly anointed by God, opponents could be regarded as Satan's little helpers. Looney Tunes, dangerously deluded. So too the fanatics who supported Potgieter. Opposing him were leaders like J.J. Berger, nicknamed Kuchi. He had a long history of feuding with Potgieter, going back all the way to when Berger was president of the Volksraad of the Natalia Republic and Potgieter was holding forth in Potchefstroom. Remember how the Natalia Republic Boers under Andries Pretorius had appealed for help from Potgieter to fight the British, and he flatly refused. While there was some respect between the two parties, Berger was totally against Potgieter's less than democratic rule, his propensity to always do things his way, the elderly Potgieter believing that the Volksraad should be answerable to him, not the other way around. About this time, 1848, word had reached the Boers at Urgstadt and Leidenbach that their arch-enemy, Mzilikazi Kakamalo of the Amandebele, had moved to a place across the Limpopo River and was within striking distance. The Amandebele had been very busy since the Boers defeated them more than a decade earlier. They had split up and migrated into Botswana and then Zimbabwe, eventually, as you know, settling near Bulawayo in western Zimbabwe. Potgieter longed to kill Mzilikazi, to revenge the death of so many Boer men, women and children killed in all those raids along the Bushman River and the Vaal. Potgieter duly led a commando to attack Mzilikazi across the Limpopo River, but he did so without permission from the Volksraad. They decided they'd deal with him when he got back. Potgieter first ran into a group of people who were paying tribute to Mzilikazi, north of the region now known as the Soutpansberg. He confronted two different chiefs living there, one called Militsi, the other Maraba. While there's a lot of evidence they were Bapedi, there's some who believe they were part of the Balemba people, those who believe they're related to the Israelites, if you recall a previous episode. Maraba submitted to the Boers, but Militsi did not, and he was defeated in a short battle and then fled the region. Potgieter never did manage to find Mzilikazi, eventually turning back to Leidenbach, and upon return proclaimed the new district for the Leidenbach Boers he called Soutpansberg. Most members of the Volksraad were incensed and refused to ratify Potgieter's transactions with Militsi. Men like J.J. Berger had taken on a conservative approach to acquiring land from black chiefs. Potgieter was too old school. He wanted all the land he could see. God had anointed him, after all. And so Potgieter had J.J. Berger arrested and imprisoned. This was a kind of last straw for many voortrekkers, even those who believed Potgieter was God's emissary. A public outcry followed, and both sets of Boers armed themselves. A civil war was imminent. J.J. Berger's men versus Potgieter's men. Eventually, Potgieter relented and agreed to submit to the arbitration of the people. All the Bergers from Potchefstroom were summoned to a meeting at Leidenbach to discuss the future. This was a momentous meeting because it was the first Boer Volkmoeter, or assembly of people from a town, district or region, which had gathered to decide critical issues. It was also the first where all the Boer members of the Transvaal reserved the right to vote on any matter of importance directly, rather than relying on the Volksraad to make a decision for them. Whatever the people voted, the Volksraad would now have to institute. After 200 years in southern Africa, the Dutch descendants had arrived at something like a democracy, at least for themselves. It was a fiery meeting, ending when it was resolved that the time had come for the Burgers to make a decision. Join Potgieter or join the Volksraad, but they could no longer be supporters of both. As we'll hear in future episodes, the political artisan called Johan Smilkamp, who's back in Holland, was going to arbitrate future disputes. Potgieter announced his section would seek new land, eyeing the area he'd raided on his hunt from Mzilikazi. So he trekked to the Soutpansberg and formed a new settlement. Potgieter was a man of his time, all right, but more than this, he appeared to have some sort of hyperactive restlessness. He was inhabited by the spirit, whom many Boers said was God's spirit. Those opposed to him regarded Potgieter as dangerously self-centered and with a restlessness born more of a psychosis. By now, he had migrated from the Cape to Oranje across the Orange, from Oranje to Potchefstroom, thence to Urgstadt and then Leidenbach. Now he was off again to the Soutpansberg. Potgieter was a traveller. He loved being on his horse, and he was always visiting Rustenburg or Potchefstroom, even Delagoa Bay. Approaching 60 years of age, he set up his final home at Schumannstall in the Soutpansberg Mountains. But his closest adherents, including the Erasmus, Wolmerans, Minnar and Bronkhorst families, trekked away from him. They headed south, leaving what you could call the Potgieter cult. It was partly a pull, not just a push, because they'd heard about a wonderful district with fantastic spring water, fountains of water, a beautiful corner of the Houtveld, which eventually was going to be celebrated as the city of Pretoria. That's where these families decided to go. Potgieter's departure from Leidenbach and Urgstadt had an immediate effect, because Potgieter had been angling towards Mswati and Somtkuba was being supported by the Volksraad Boers. This new trek was significant for a number of reasons. Amaswazi oral tradition speaks of how seriously Somtkhuba was challenging Mswati's authority at this moment. For one, the elder brother had held on to Mswati's royal herd, the Ludlambedlu, based at the royal center, Eludlambedwini village. Somtkhuba had not handed all the cattle back to Mswati, and by the middle of 1849, the young king's patience snapped. And with Potgieter's departure, things were going to move ahead at a pace. What happened next is for next episode. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps elevate visibility, and you can head off to my site, desmondlatham.blog, where I'm going to load an update about this episode. You can email me from there or sign up for my newsletter. Until next, Salagali.